This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Well, thank you very much. I am grateful to be back here grateful to the abbot for asking me to do a Dharma talk this morning for the second time. I'm grateful also to my friend Max, the Reverend Max, for bringing me here for the first time. And I want to acknowledge that my parents are here all the way from Washington, D.C., so thank you. I come here today in a little bit of a different relationship with the Hartford Street Zen Center and with Zen Buddhism than I did the last time I spoke. I have been here as a guest. I've been here as an interfaith speaker, and that's been very nice. I was here for Max's ordination. It was beautiful and lovely. I have been here as a speaker for the board of the Zen Center. That was nice. But I have recently started coming here weekly on Wednesdays for my own meditation practice. And that's a little bit of a new thing for me. So I have sat Zazen here as a guest before, and I sat Zazen as a speaker before, but now I'm really kind of exploring in an intentional way and with guidance that I'm very grateful for from the abbot and from Max and from David and from so many of the other people who I've met here in my own journey of stillness and the practice of meditation. So that's been a little different. I am totally unqualified to teach Buddhism. However, am now here kind of as a learner, and that's really been very wonderful. What I can offer you is some of the wisdom of my own tradition with the idea that we really, my practice here at the Zen Center helps me to be a better Jew and a better rabbi. And it may be that that our interfaith encounter this morning will help everybody along in the journey that we're all on. And that's my hope. So when I come for practice, you know, we all have problems in our lives. And sometimes people say things to us that are unkind, and that when I meditate, sometimes I think if I'm not careful and if I don't listen very, very carefully to the guidance that I've been offered, I find myself sort of reliving my worst experiences of the week during Zazen. You know, my mind will go to those things that bother me the most, and that's not religion. Right? There's no reason to put ourselves through that. But it's a trap that I know I fall into. And so one of the pieces of wisdom that I have been trying to focus on during my whole week from my tradition is a line from our book of prayers. It says, Ulim klalli nafshi tidom. In front of my slanderer, may my soul be silent. It's a very hard thing, I think, for all of us, because it's those sort of unkindnesses of life that I just find myself wanting to respond to. They may make me angry, and anger is a problem, you know, that I particularly deal with. And when I have had an experience that makes me angry, I may shoot that second arrow at myself, that teaching, that, you know, pain is like two arrows. The first time is being hit with one arrow and then, you know, clinging to it and perseverating on it is like being hit with a second arrow. And so I find myself, if I'm not careful, shooting that second arrow at myself. And so I sort of come back to this idea, in front of my slanderer, may my soul be silent. May my soul be like the dust to everyone. Very hard, very difficult sort of teaching. I think Western culture encourages us to respond to a slanderer, to file a lawsuit, to file some sort of complaint, to stand up for ourselves. Okay, those are fine things to do in some cases, but we don't have to do them in our heads all the time, right? So that's a difference. And when I find myself, I don't know, filing that lawsuit that of course I'm never gonna file in my head all the time, I find myself reliving my most difficult experiences, and I find myself falling away from the path of religion, because that's not religious, right? And so may my soul be silent. As we explore that this morning, we're gonna go on a journey through the stages of the worlds of Jewish spirituality. We have kind of a concept of four worlds. And I wanna sort of introduce it to you, because at the height of the mountain there, we find something that I think may bring us together. So the first of those four worlds is the world of details, the world of doing. So, you know, just look around the room for a minute and notice all of the details of the things that are here, the wood of the floor, you can touch it, my voice, etc., right? All the details of what's going on, the way the walls are, I love the lights in this space. They're very nice, you know, just noticing that. All of those things happen in the world of details, the world of doing, the physical world that we live in, right? Okay. Then there is the world of art. I'm just going to call it the world of art. Emotions. The way I would explain this is what's going on in the room that's not in the room. What's going on right here in this room that isn't in this room, right? How are we relating? Is the talk interesting, right? Are we in a sense of community here, right? How do we relate as a sangha? How do we relate as a community? How do we relate to our larger community? So those relationships are big. How do we feel, right? What's the feeling in the room? What if I were to take the temperature of the Zendo right now emotionally? What's the sort of feeling? This isn't made up. These feelings are really here. And in a profession like religious leadership, or certainly like chaplaincy, where Max and I work, you deal with the second world all the time, right? What's going on in the room that's not in the room? That's the second world. From there, the third world is the world of, I guess the world of creation. That's a hard thing. But the world of abstraction. Okay, so, you know, if I'm eating a blueberry, I ate a blueberry this week. It was a delicious blueberry. It was just really good. And I can, you know, I can appreciate the details of that blueberry, but I can also just appreciate that there are blueberries in general. We live in a universe that's given us blueberries. And those blueberries kind of live in the third world. It's the idea of blueberries in general. It's not the Platonic heaven. It's not where the world, the single ideal blueberry lives, and the closer you are to that blueberry, the more you have blueberryness. And that's a fine point of philosophy, but that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is it's the sort of, you know, gratitude that there are such things as blueberries. Okay, so the blueberries live there. People, right? Not individual people, but just, gosh, it's so cool that there are people. Wow. You know, look at us, right? Not us individually, but just look at people. We're wonderful. We're wondrous, right? That kind of wonder lives in the third world. I might call it the world of wonder. That might make more sense. And in the fourth world, there's nothing to say. There's nothing to say. It isn't that there's nothing, it's that there aren't any words. And maybe this makes a little bit more sense here than it might make when, you know, when I try to teach this in other places. There just aren't any words. Because the thing about the way Jewish mysticism views the world is that the distinctions between things for us are real. It's we certainly consider them real. There's a real difference between me and a glass of water. It's just that the distinctions don't go all the way up. And so this is our view. And so think of them as if they were cubicle walls. So down here, kind of close to the floor, there's really a wall there, right? And if you don't know how to fly, you're going to run into the wall. It's okay, right? There's a wall between me and a glass of water. That makes sense down in the world of details. It makes very good sense, right? But the farther up we go, at some point, we recognize the truth that there isn't really, you know, in a sense, any difference between me and the glass of water. We're both made of stuff, you know. And even that intellectualizing doesn't quite reach it. There is a unity to the truth of nothingness, right? There is a truth that we in some way aren't, you know? It's not that we don't live lives. It's that we're bubbles in an ocean, and eventually those bubbles pop in the air. And we're all just popped bubbles when that happens. And so in a sense, we really are all part of the same. There isn't anything to say in the fourth world. Words bring you down to the third world if you're the third world is kind of intellectual. Words bring you down there if you're doing well. If you're not doing so well at this, words will bring you all the way down to the first floor, you know, which is not a bad place to be. It's just that it isn't very spiritual. So when you get all the way up to the fourth world, there aren't any distinctions between anything. There's only one point at the peak of the mountain. And at that point, there's nothing to say. And that brings us wisdom, I think. So when I try to have my soul be silent, right? In front of my slanderer, may my soul be silent. I try to get to a place of silence. I find it helpful to get to a place of the truth of no distinctions. To get to a place of the truth of not having an identity, not needing one, to find compassion from the idea that we're all, you know, there's no blank to fill in after we're all, we're just all, we're all. That's what it is. And I do find compassion, I think, there, and compassion can help. So compassion is nothing but feeling the same, right? That's what the word means. And so when we access the truth of our sameness, compassion for me flows from that. If I go down to the world of details, I might find compassion too, but I also find anger, reaction, clinging, attachment. There are a lot of things I like. There are a lot of things I wish I had that I don't have. There are a lot of things I wish I did not have that I have. Those things sometimes make me upset or fearful or angry. And those live down here, where my body lives. And that's okay. I'm not denying the truth that I'm a person with an identity. That's also true, but it doesn't negate the fact that there's only one point at the peak and that there's nothing to say. Okay. So to help us understand these four worlds a little bit better, I am going to introduce four children. And the children are going to help us up to the top, I think. So there's a story in the story in our in Judaism in the story of Passover that, you know, the Jewish Hebrew slaves came out of Egypt, okay, and God took us out of Egypt. This is the story. And while we're celebrating that, we tell a story about four children, and they ask questions about what we're celebrating. The wise child says, "What are all the rituals, laws, and customs of the observation of the holiday that marks the exodus from Egypt?" Right? That your eternal God has commanded you. And to the wise child, we are instructed to respond with all of the details of all of the laws that must be observed, down to the last one, which is, we do not eat anything after the dessert. The second child is the wicked child. The wicked child says, "What do you mean by this service?" And the text says, by the word "you," it is clear that he does not include himself. And so you are instructed to respond to the wicked child harshly, saying, "If you had been in Egypt, you would not have been worthy to be redeemed." The third child is the simple child. The simple child says, "What is this?" And for the simple child, you are to answer simply. And in Judaism, God brought us out of Egypt with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. So we're taught to respond to the simple child. The fourth child is the child who does not know to ask. And the text says, with the child who does not know to ask, you have to take the initiative yourself. As it is written, you will teach your child on that day. Okay? So we have four children. I think that these four children are often read totally wrong. Totally wrong. But I think that if we approach them with compassion, they may be able to help us get up the mountain. And so, you know, when I teach this to Jewish audiences, I say, which child corresponds to which world? And they want to put the wise child with the top, with the fourth world, because the wise child is the best. The wise child is the favorite. I don't think so. I think the wise child is going to help us see the world of details. The wise child is very, very attentive to the details of Jewish law. They want to know how to do everything properly. That's important. I see etiquette here too in the Zendo that I'm trying to learn. That's important. It's not wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. But the wise child doesn't see anything else. The wise child misses the forest for the trees. The wise child is so intent on the trees that they are unable to see what else is going on. And I don't think the wise child is the favorite of this tale. I think the wise child in some ways is sort of a cautionary tale that if you ask a question about way too many details, you're going to get an answer about way too many details. And I think that's true here too. I mean, because what I find, and I've only really been seriously meditating for a short period of time, I've had prior experience in my life, but this practice is new for me. But I do find that if I'm way too concentrating on details, that's all I'm going to be able to see. We gained a piece of wisdom this morning from the abbot about, you know, I said that I thought that meditation was about not having any thoughts, or trying not to have thoughts. And the abbot says, no, that's not so useful. What you want to do is imagine that you're a house with a front door and a back door, and let them go through and don't make them a cup of tea. So I really appreciated that, and that was good learning for me because, you know, if I try not to have thoughts, I end up clinging to thoughts. That's the way it works. I end up thinking about not having thoughts. And so I end up like the wise child, wondering what are the techniques, right? What are the, and it's not that there aren't techniques that I ought to learn. It's just that that's not all there is. And if I'm obsessing about them during my practice, I'm not practicing. So the wicked child, totally misunderstood. The wicked child is my favorite. I love the wicked child. The wicked child is all about emotions, preoccupied with their relationship to what's going on. It's a difficult relationship, embroiled in difficult emotions. The wicked child sees emotions. And in some ways, the wicked child misses the trees for the forest. The wicked child is the only one of the four who recognizes the service as a worship service. Jewish audiences, I go into a little more detail on that. But the wicked child correctly sees what's going on, but doesn't really care about the etiquette and the details. That's also a mistake. But the wicked child at least has seen that there's more to what's in the room than the details that are in the room. And so the wicked child kind of, I think, illustrates the second world of spirituality, the world of relationships and emotion, right? So preoccupied, in fact, is that child with relationships and emotion that they're unable to be in the details. So that helps us see the distinction between those two. Otherwise, the second world is hard to understand. The third child, the simple child, asks the best question. What is this? The best question. And I think if we go through our lives asking, what is this, regularly, we will find wisdom, because it is a great question. It's not a stupid question. It's a fantastic question. What is this? I mean, I could ask right now, what in the world is this? If you had told me 5 years ago that I would be in a room that looks like this, I would have thought, well, that's interesting. I don't know anything about that, right? What in the world is this? It's a place where we face the wall and don't do anything for a period of 40 minutes at a time, right? It's a great question. What are we doing here? Why do we do that? What is going on? You can answer, the word simple is a fantastic word. It could mean first grade. Fine, it's okay to be in first grade. Or it could mean the beauty of the wholeness of taking it all in and really kind of getting beyond. Yes, I understand that there are people who are sitting on cushions and in rows and kind of around the side of the room, and that they're listening to me say words. That's the first world, right? Yes, I understand that a lot of us are friends here, and that we have a beautiful community here at the Hartford Street Zen Center, and that I, in some way, am part of that community. It's a beautiful thing. That's the second world, right? But what is this? Buddhism, Buddha, God, Judaism. How in the world are we? What is it that we're doing here? Right? It's a great question, and I don't know that there's a simple answer to it. It's worth thinking about, right? That's the third world, the appreciation of the fact that we're here at all, in general. Right? The child who does not know to ask, usually interpreted as the child who doesn't know how to ask, often illustrated as a baby, somebody who doesn't have words yet, so you have to take the initiative yourself, right? Could be. It also could be a child who doesn't know that they're allowed to ask. Somebody who might be marginalized. Somebody who might be feeling apart from community. Somebody who, maybe because they don't know the etiquette or because they find something strange, feels themselves a stranger. And is so worried about causing offense that they don't know to ask. Or it could be somebody who doesn't know what to ask, I know that I don't know everything, but I'm not sure what to ask. I'm not sure what to say about this. A child who doesn't know to ask is silent. Is silent. The word that is used for silence in my verse, in front of my slanderer, may my soul be silent. Nafshi tidom. This word tidom, dom, is a very kind of severe word for silence. There are other words in Hebrew for silence. This is a severe word. There's a story in the Bible where Aaron, Moses' brother, watches his two sons die at the altar. They did something wrong and they get zapped and they die. And Aaron was silent with this word dom. He was struck silent. It's a very severe kind of word. So when I say in front of my slanderer, may my soul be silent, there is a difficulty to that. It's not easy. I'm not saying, you know, it would be great for me to be at a spiritual level where I could have this equanimity to just say, oh, well, that's okay. You know, we move on. I'm not there. I'd like to be there. May you in this community help me get there in my practice here. It'd be great. But I'm not there yet. And so I don't have that. And sometimes I might be struck silent, right? Struck silent. There are four categories of things that the rabbis have that are in the world. They are things that are sentient life, animal life, plant life, things that bloom, and inanimate objects. 1, 2, 3, 4. When I ask Jewish audiences how they would correspond those to the four worlds, very often they want to put sentient life at the top because it's better. You know, in some way we're able to, you know, appreciate, you know, the truth of non-being. We have written about it as human beings. We have this discourse, right, in words. What do rocks know, right? What do rocks appreciate? Well, I would put it the other way. I would say that our four categories are nested, right? So there's sentient life, life that moves, all life, plants and everything go in that third, and, you know, the life force that's in everything. But those things are silent. Rocks and you know, air. In the first world, we as human beings get to sort of span all of this in our minds and our thoughts. Maybe we even do approach that mountain peak of the fourth world in meditation, maybe not. But when we talk, we are in the world of details. And we live in the world of details. In the second world, the world of emotions and relationships and art, we share those emotions and relationships with all animals. Animals have emotions and relationships too. And so that's kind of our animal self. We lose our details, our intelligence, our you know, as we go up. And we sort of interact with the world like animals, with emotions. In the third world, it's just our life. It's not the emotions, it's not the individuality, it's not what's going on in the room at all, it's just that we're kind of here. And so we share that with all of the life, and I'm so glad the abbot opened the back door because we see a lot of life out here, trees and grass, and some of the trees have leaves, some of them don't, and so there's that seasonality and that wonder, and we share that with them. If we go higher than that, we are sharing with the bricks and we are sharing with the rocks. Can we be as still as a rock? The rabbis call the rocks and bricks and things like that domim. They are silent. Same word. Can we be silent like a rock? if something strikes us silent, can we just be like a brick? There. There's nothing to say at that level. And because there's nothing to say, we are just there. We're just present in the same way that a rock is present, I think. Speaking from my own tradition's perspective. When we can achieve presence, not so much this conscious presence, but the presence of a rock, the presence of a brick, the presence of wood, the presence of, all these things that are really wonderful, right? We may have just reached the place where there's nothing to say, where there's nothing to ask. Maybe the child who doesn't know to ask is a child who knows not to ask. Maybe that's somebody who has, who is at a level where there just isn't anything to say at all. And there's just to be. Rocks know how to be. That's one thing they know. They're very good at it. They're better at it than me. Their foot doesn't fall asleep. They don't have face itches. These are the things that plague me in my practice. I'm really kind of a beginner. But the rocks and the bricks and the wooden railing out there are so much better at it than I am. Right. And so it's in that fourth world. It's not that I want to negate my intelligence. That's not what I'm saying. It's just that in the fourth world, it doesn't matter as much. It doesn't matter as much. And so what I try to do is to cultivate that as much as I can. It's sort of what I came in here to try to learn. And it's not, as I said, it's not as though I'm competent at it, but I'm just kind of aiming for it. And if I can do that, I may find that my soul learns how to be silent. And, it doesn't have to be rationalized. Wrong things happen to us. And, down here on the first floor, I like to sort of, the balance sheet needs to even out. And if there's a wrong, then I need to do something to correct it. And so the ledger evens out, right? But up at the top, there's nothing to even out. There's only one point at the top of the mountain. There's nothing to add. There's nothing to subtract. There's nothing to respond to. And if I can learn to spend a little bit of time there, I may find that I know how to not ask. I may find that that I don't know. Right? There's not knowing. I may find that I don't know to ask. And so instead of seeing that as sort of a negative thing or a vessel to be filled, I think it's, it's interesting that I'm trying to progress from knowing to not knowing. It's the opposite of the kind of learning that I'm used to. And that may be what that fourth child has to teach. So I just want to thank you again. I think there's some time for questions, and which I would welcome. And I again thank you so much for having me here. Yes, sir.
You may be aware that in Buddhism we frequently use the term body-mind as opposed to body and mind. And as I understand, the emphasis being that not to get caught up in dualism, essentially. That,
yeah.
And even to say dualism and non-dualism is being caught in dualism.
Right.
So I'm wondering if there's anything in Jewish philosophy or whatever, however it is you would frame it, of any kind of interpenetration of these four levels as opposed to a stratification?
Oh, beautiful question. Thank you, David. Yes. interpenetration of the four levels as opposed to a stratification. So they're all true at once, and they definitely interact. I think of the children as sitting around a table as a family. It's a good point. We don't want to get into dualism in our tradition, because it interferes with our appreciation of the unity of the universe. And we definitely don't want to get into kind of a four-part, what would you call that, a whatever word that is, but
quadrality.
A quadrality, thank you. We definitely don't want to get into that. That's right. We definitely don't want to get into a quadrality or a dualism of dualisms. We do have these kind of schematics. Another one is the schematic of the 10 sphirot of Kabbalah, which corresponds to the chakras. And so we have these sort of diagrams. But, we do need to remember that they're all mixed together. You know, it reminds me of a line in the book Cry the Beloved Country, South Africa, by the author's name is escaping me. I'm sorry.
Patton.
Pardon me?
Alan Patton.
Was it?
Alan Patton.
I apologize. I don't remember because I just love this book, Cry the Beloved Country. And, it's about apartheid era South Africa. And there's a scene at which there's a white woman who made jello, and she made jello in these stratified layers. And she says that society should be like the jello. It looks much nicer when the layers don't mix. And this is very, very wrong. And I think the example from that novel helps us see how wrong that is. The idea of different layers not mixing and stratifying them. We need to realize that there's one unity to the universe. That's why it's called a universe. And if things are, if there are distinctions to be made, they mix. They're always mixed. They have to be mixed. It's ugly and wrong for it not to be mixed. Does that answer the question?
It addresses it. Yeah, I don't know about an answer. I don't know if I was looking for an answer. I was just curious if there was an approach to sort of, I wouldn't even say intermingling, because then, I can't, it's very hard to talk about, isn't it? And sometimes, I think in Buddhism anyways, and I think maybe perhaps in Judaism and many other traditions, it's like there's talk, and language is very handy, right?
Right.
But it's only language.
Right. Right.
It's a way we get caught up in language, and so we divide things out, you, me, black, white, so on and so forth.
Right.
And when really it's just sort of hopefully an expeditious means in which to explain everything to everything.
Yeah. Coming back to the jello thing, maybe think of the four worlds as color lenses. So if you want to see the third world, you can look at the world through the lens of that color, and that's what you're going to see, right? The truth is that everything's all together. But we can sort of put on, red glasses and see that part of the world that's red. It may help us see some things. It may help us filter other things out when we're looking for something in particular. But we need to remember that the world isn't red like that. It's actually kind of a multicolored world. In terms of rabbis who have written about the interaction, I mean, the only thing I would say right now is that they're definitely seem to be all true at once. It's not that you sort of take a spaceship and leave the first world and go to the second world. They're definitely all here at once.
Am I permitted to?
Of course.
Ask me a question. Thank you, Rabbi. Another way of looking at this is that the way every Jewish religious service is structured, and please correct me, because I'll probably get it wrong, there are three parts. Not four, by the way. Three parts. The first is creation, and we marvel about creation. The second is remembrance, right? We remember how, according to the legend, we were saved, we were brought from Egypt. And the third is revelation. And the most sacred prayer in Judaism, in all Jewish traditions, goes like this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And it's all about unity. And there are some Jews who will put their hands over their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I just close my eyes, and many people keep them open. But to try to imagine at that moment the unity of everything, the unity of everything. So when I hear the rabbi talk about the unity at the top, that unity permeates all of Jewish tradition, all of Jewish thinking, all of Jewish worship.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yes, there are the three phases of worship, the creation, the remembrance, the revelation. But when we get to the revelation, that prayer is a prayer that every Jew knows, even Jews who do not practice. Hear, O Israel. And another interesting thing is that when we get to the top, what's that prayer say? It says, hear.
Right.
It doesn't say speak. It doesn't say talk. It doesn't say shout. We do a lot of that mm-hmm. in the other parts of the service.
Mm-hmm.
It says, hear. Listen. Mm-hmm. Listen to the rocks. Listen to the whatever it is, the unity of the universe. So this is something that very, very deeply permeates our tradition. And I thought that the previous question was an excellent one, because I don't know, I have a problem with all of these schematics and diagrams and distinctions, because to me what worship means when Marjorie and I go to Friday night service or whatever, is being together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then at that moment thinking, everybody is together. Everybody is thinking and saying this at the same time. And it's not just everybody, it's the unity of the universe. Okay, sorry.
Right.
Thank you.
I didn't ask a question.
I don't know how to ask that question.
Ah, very good. Well, that's sometimes the best question. I love that. Listen to the rocks. Or hear what the rocks are saying. It doesn't even say listen, it says hear. What are the rocks saying? Hear it. You know, I may attempt to hear the rocks the next time I sit. That's an interesting one. Other questions? Yes.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you, first of all. It was great to hear the comparison of our face. I was very fascinated by your appreciation of the wicked child, and I want to spend some time thinking about that world of emotions and not looking at it as wicked and painful and mm-hmm. experiencing maybe wonder about it or joy or whatever.
Yeah.
Some of these other expressions. So that was an interesting observation that you made. And
thank you.
Helpful for me.
I love the wicked child. The parenting advice is wrong. It's also wrong. I mean, the Bible actually has that, and the Passover book misquotes it. So it's you know, the advice is actually wrong in Judaism too. It's interesting. It's a puzzle. It's, you know, I think you're supposed to kind of encounter it. I love wicked children. I really do. I recently applied for a job as a Jewish religious school principal. Everybody here, I don't think I'm going to get it. If I do get it, it's because they really want somebody with my perspective, because I have a different perspective than most people. But one of the things I said in my cover letter is I introduced this idea of the wicked child. Usually blows people's minds in Judaism, because we're used to imagining the wicked child as bad, a bad child, right? And I, no, the wicked child is acting out because they have correctly apprehended the magnitude of what's going on. They don't know how to deal with it. But they're acting out because they understand what's happening. And they understand what's in the room that's not in the room. It's big. It matters. And it maybe it makes them uncomfortable. It brings up emotions. And so they act out. They're a child, right? And I, you know, I said in my cover letter, I love wicked children, and I certainly invite any teacher to send them to my office. But, you know, that somebody who's acting out as a wicked child may need some acknowledgement that they appreciate something that's happening. You know, it may be that sort of time out and punishment isn't the right answer to the question that child is asking. And they're, you know, they're at a level where they're asking a question and they need an answer and they're acting out because they're not getting it. I think we all know people like that. They're not all children. But I love the wicked child. I think the wicked child is wicked awesome. Right, like a Bostonian, right. Yeah, other questions?
I just wanted to point out, when you said you were saying something that sounded kind of platonic, and I was thinking, oh, that sounds platonic, and you immediately said, this is not the heaven of the Platonists or of Plato at the same time, and I thought, oh, okay, you answered that without me even asking that.
A lot of people say the third world is Platonic heaven. It's not right. Those are different ideas. But you often hear that in Jewish audiences. So Plato's heaven says that there is an ideal cushion that lives up in Plato's heaven, right? And the closer an object is to that ideal cushion, the more cushion-like it is. That's what it means to be cushion-like. So this thing here is, you know, it's maybe more cushion-like than, a wrecking ball with spikes. I'm holding up a glass of water for people listening. But it's not very cushion-like. It's wet, you know, et cetera. This thing is very cushion-like, but it's not as cushion-like as a cushion, right? It's a mat. It's rather cushion-like. This thing is somewhat less cushion-like. Okay, that's Plato's heaven. There really is a cushion up there, the best cushion. The very best cushion, right? Maybe it has a tuft of blonde hair that's, you know, dyed orange in front of it. The best cushion. No. This is about, it's so cool that there are cushions, right? When I say the word cushions, I don't mean a list of cushions, right? When I say it's so cool that there are such things as cushions, I don't mean here are the 37,900,000 cushions on my list in the world that I'm appreciating, right? These 17 that are here in the room, and then the one that's, you know, over there in Iran somewhere, and then there's, you know, there's a cushion in Japan. That's not what I'm saying, right? Two different, right? There are a lot of cushions in Japan.
Usually, this one, the zabuton, is more formal and popular cushion.
Ah, okay. So there are even different types of cushions. And so I could not possibly be talking about all those details, right? Because I don't even know the details. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, oh, wow, it's cool that there are cushions, right? That's the third world. That's what it is. For a Jewish audience, I'd be talking about creation. God made blueberries. It's not that God made this particular blueberry. It's that God made blueberries in general. And I think outside of Judaism, it's really just appreciation that there are such things. That's cool, right? The cushions that I'm appreciating, the blueberries that I'm appreciating, that's the third world. It's not this specific object. Yeah. So the difference between that and Plato. Nothing wrong with Plato's heaven. It's a fine philosophy to study. It's just that it isn't what we're saying.
Is it like, is the Platonic ideal being, it's like the template of all other cushions? The cushion.
Yeah, that's there, how I understand it. It's like there's an actual template of all other cushions.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, let's just appreciate that there are cushions. Now, why is that a gateway to the fourth world? Because, I think partly because, at least, if we can appreciate our sort of peopleness, right? Not that there's one ideal person that the closer we are to, the more people like we are. That's a horrible idea. That leads to racism and all sorts of things, right? But if we can appreciate that we are, you know, people, and gosh, how cool it is that there are people, right? We have managed to conquer a little bit of our, you know, detail-oriented and emotional-oriented self. Conquer's the wrong word. We've managed to sort of convince them to be quiet for a minute. You know, we've managed to convince them to be quiet for a minute so that we can sit with the fact that, gosh, you know, I'm a, you know, a peoplehood, peopleness. And I think that, you know, if we can even convince that to be quiet for a minute, or rather, let it go in and out and not make it a cup of tea, as the abbot taught me this morning, then, you know, we may be able to sort of get higher than that.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Maybe,
sorry, abbot?
Maybe we can stop now.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll be upstairs for tea and cookies, so I just want to thank you all again, and Abbott, thank you very much.